Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This is the hour we get to spend together, figure out what happened this week, what did it mean, what did it really mean, and I have always a panel of super friends with me. Joni Balter is the host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Hey, Joni.
Hey there.
Bill Bryant, former Port of Seattle commissioner, former Republican candidate for governor. Good to see you, Bill. Thanks for coming back.
It's always great to be here.
Hannah Brooks Olson is a writer and political strategist, taking a break from campaigns. I understand you're editing Real Change now.
That is correct.
Ah, well, thanks for coming on. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with elections. Washington Democrats are talking happily about this week's primary election. They did relatively well in the primaries for Congress and the state legislature. Does this mean there will be a blue wave in November, though? Joni Balter.
Absolutely is going to be a blue wave. The only question is how high and how consuming of, shall we say, three of our Republican members of Congress. You know, these kind of numbers, it's been said many a time here that primaries around here really do tell you much, not everything, but much about general elections. And you have three congressional races that were close enough for everybody to be recalculating and figuring out where the money is going to come in. I'm talking about the 5th Congressional District over around Spokane.
Kathy McMorris Rodgers, very prominent Republican. She's like the 5th-ranked Republican?
4th-ranking, yes. Yeah. And so she has quite a challenge. She's only 2 points ahead right now of her Democratic challenger, longtime legislator Lisa Brown. And so that's one that has potential for the Democrats for this wave to hit. The sleeper was down in the 3rd Congressional District, and my good friend Peter Jackson called this on the shores of Lake Chelan, said, that's the sleeper, pay attention.
And this is Jamie Herrera Butler.
Yeah, she had something like 42 or 43%, which is not enough.
She's a Republican.
To feel really like, oh, I'm so comfortable. I think she should be mightily uncomfortable about what will happen there. And then there's the 8th Congressional District, which is really up for grabs.
Literally, that's the open seat.
That's the open seat. And if you look at that, you know, what we do, and it's a little dangerous.
We should tell people east side into the real east side. Issaquah's in there, but so is Ellensburg.
Everybody's calling it the terrier-shaped district. And so what's interesting
there is spanning the mountains.
This has never been represented by a Democrat before. And so you'd think that a man with great name familiarity like Dino Rossi would be like, you know, he's going to win that. But if you add up Dino Rossi's numbers, you get from this primary, you get to about 47%. If you add up the three Democrats, and we don't even have a finalist yet on that, you get to closer to 50. So he's the underdog here. Everyone thought, well, wow, all that name familiarity. Name familiarity is, you know, that's a normal kind of way to read an election, but not this year. This year's wild.
Okay, let's bring some other people in. Bill Bryant, Joni, you're a Republican, Bill, and Joni was just throwing blue paint all over the room. Do you agree, blue wave?
Well, there's blue paint to be thrown around. Joni's right. This is a time when I think, I haven't talked to the campaigns, but I would hope they would be recalculating and reevaluating, as Joni suggested. Yes, primaries are not the end game. November is what counts, and I think you had a lot of Republicans, and traditionally I've experienced this, where if you have a Republican front runner, the Republicans are like, well, we know that person's going to advance, so why do we even need to vote? And I think you see that in certain areas where you had a low Republican turnout because there really wasn't a contested Republican primary. Yes, do not blow it off and excuse it and say that's the only issue here. There are some issues that need to be addressed, but I think it's also wrong to err on the other side and say this is a blue wave and it's all going to swamp us in November, because I think a lot of Republicans will come home and will vote in November, and some of these races that appear to be threatened are going to really tighten up. Having said that, they better take this seriously, because the situation is very fluid. I do think that over in Spokane, that Congresswoman McMorris Rodgers pulls it out. I think that Lisa is her opponent is too liberal for that district. I think Jamie Herrera Butler pulls it out. But you can see that there are issues on the coast, an area that I was the first Republican to carry in generations, have begun to go back to the Democrat side. That needs to be shorn up. And there's also some issues you can see in the House races in suburban Vancouver. So that needs to be addressed.
So you're predicting Republicans in the two seats, congressional seats we just talked about,
yes.
in the 8th district, Dino Rossi or
in the
his
eighth
unknown
district,
opponent?
Yeah, in the 8th district, Joni is right. I think name ID is less important in the suburbs if you have a reaction to whoever is the Republican candidate. It doesn't really matter who it is. And in some cases, if that's where the voter's mind is, it doesn't matter who the Democrat is. They just want to send a message. But again, you had very low turnout in some of the rural areas that will come home and vote for Dino. Dino can get 10 points less than I did in Sammamish Issaquah and still win if he carries the rest of those areas as I did. He's okay. not going to do 10 points worse than I did because he's from Sammamish Issaquah. So I think at the end of the day, while there's going to be a lot of attention and a lot of money focused on this race.
So are you predicting no wave?
That's what I'm here. Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, a lot of these races come down to who that people want to represent them on local issues as much as big federal issues. And if the Democrats just want to run on an anti-Trump platform, they might be disappointed in November.
Okay. So it reminds me of when they say tsunami on the coast and people go out there to see it. They said, no, that's crazy. Don't go anywhere near it. And they get the bottom of their pants leg wet.
Well, the first thing that happens before a tsunami is that the wave retracts. Uh-huh. So that's actually the first thing you know when a tsunami is coming is there's a drawing back first.
Which is it, Hannah?
Well, so I think it's different race by race. I think it's very
that's
hard to
exactly
look at the whole
right.
thing and say, like, oh, this is all one big sign. Because I think we're seeing, you know, with someone like Dino Rossi, like, yeah, Dino Rossi has a lot of name recognition for losing. So, you know, like, that's what people know him as a failed candidate. And regardless of which side you fall on, that seat was held by Dave Reichert for so long. And I think Dave Reichert, it doesn't matter how you feel politically on a lot of things. He's a likable guy. He's a long-standing member of the community. He caught the Green River Killer. Like, Dino Rossi is no Dave Reichert. So I think it's like, it's not, in this particular situation, it's not even like having, you know, a generic Republican in that seat is very helpful because I think in a lot of ways, Dino Rossi's name recognition could be not helpful. And then the other thing that's happening with the 8th that I think is interesting is it is such an unusually drawn district, and it encompasses a lot of people. But one of a large number of the population there is immigrant families who have either been priced out of the urban cores in Seattle, Tacoma, or who work in ag, who work in shipping and receiving, you know, like a lot of different industries. And for them, the Trump tax plan is not a seller. Like the Trump tax
doesn't
plan
doesn't do anything for them.
It does nothing
right.
for them.
Yeah, exactly.
And not only that, but, you know, Dino Rossi being like hard on immigration, like that doesn't go over well with those populations for those people. And like, the other thing I think, you know, in some places it's candidate-based. I think that's what's happening with Dino. And I think that's why you can see also in the 8th, like, no one Democrat came out really strongly because I think people were, like, not really, you know, sold on any one of them. But I think in other races it's very much issues-based. And I think there's nothing intrinsically political about wanting health care that doesn't make you go bankrupt, you know, or wanting schools that are amply funded. And so I think people are really voting on issues specifically, like you said, like, just to local issues and
The Democrat,
well, needs to pay
yeah, I agree.
For this open seat, it's going to be Dino Rossi, the Republican, against either Kim Schreier or Jason Ritterizer, and they're only separated by about 1,200 votes. Kim Schreier has the lead now. Does it matter for the general election? Which of those two Democrats has the better chance against Dino Rossi?
Well, I think the Democrat at the end of it is what will drive that race. It's not so much people don't know these challengers.
Right.
The big thing going on here, of course, it's issues. Of course, over in the 5th Congressional District, people will
Spokane area.
Spokane area.
The whole eastern end of the state. Mm-hmm.
The people will learn that Kathy McMorris Rogers did not help them when they needed health care.
Right.
She worked against them. But I got to say, the big thing here is if you think about the president's trip to London and they had that giant balloon of him as a baby, think of that looming over all of these races.
Yeah.
And then think about who is voting in these races. Suburbanites and women don't like the big baby balloon. They don't. They're not digging it. They're gonna vote against it. And so that's very important. For one second, if we could look at the Senate race, if you call it a race, which it isn't, you had Republican Susan.
My ballot just went on and on.
Oh my
Maria
God.
Cantwell and
pages
30 people.
Pages and pages.
Right.
Yeah.
So
and
you
and
look
all different
at that.
Parties.
So you want to say there it's not a wave? Hello. Susan Hutchinson yeah. did horrible. 24%. She only won, is it only a hit, I guess I'm supposed to say at this point in it, in like 5 counties. There are many Republican counties where she's behind. I mean, I'm pretty sure the Mariner Moose could have done better than she did in this. This is
But when
is
it comes to the general
stuff.
Election, and it's either R or D, Do you expect it to
I think the Senate race.
Maria Cantwell's not going to lose that
No,
race, right?
I think the Senate race is one where you do have a federal issue here. Well, I will argue on these legislative races, and there might be, you know, there might have been this anti-Trump and motivation on the Democratic side to come out. We'll see if that continues through November or whether local issues become more predominant as this campaign's mature. But in the Senate race, that's a federal race. Susan Hutchinson has made it, you know, who's a loyal supporter of the president's, has made it very clear that she should be elected because she can talk to the president as a supporter of the president's, whereas Senator Cantwell has opposed the president. So you've set up this narrative. You want to elect a senator who can work with the president and talk to him, or do you want to elect somebody who opposes the president? And as Joni said, it was very, you know, clear that a lot of people were not sure how they wanted to vote on that. And you had a lot of Republicans who were staying home. In Benton County, for example, which is over in the Tri-Cities, it's a very conservative Republican area. Mike McGavick and the combined Republican vote when Mike McGavick challenged Senator Cantwell received 69%. When Mike Baumgardner challenged Maria Cantwell, the combined Republican vote, I think, was in the high 50s, low 60s. Just to throw another race in there, when Mr. Trump was on the ballot, I received...
You were running for governor.
And I was running for governor, not the Senate, but it was a year when he was on the ballot. I think our combined Republican vote in the primary was 62%. The combined Republican vote in Benton County was barely 50%.
Yeah. And that should tell you that there is some sort of wave coming.
Kathy McMorris Rogers, briefly, does that... You heard about the tape that came out.
Oh, with
Nebuchadnezzar. At a fundraiser for McMorris Rogers, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, told the crowd how important it is to not lose seats like Kathy McMorris Rogers. And he said, we need Republicans to keep Trump in office. If the special counsel, Robert Mueller, won't clear the president, he said, we're the only ones, which is really the danger. We have to keep all these seats. If we do not keep the majority, all of this goes away. Is that, I don't know that it's surprising. Is it important? Is it?
I mean, Kathy McMorris Rogers has made no efforts to separate herself from Trump at all. In fact, she's aligned with him very closely. So I think the fact that she would continue to align with him and some of his, you know, most predominant supporters is not surprising. I do think, though, I just think the timing for people running as Republicans this year is very difficult with the Trump tax plan, with the looming trade war, you know, like things that are really that stick for people in Spokane and in agricultural business and in you know, like areas of shipping, like in those industries. And so I think that's just super hard to overcome. I think Susan Hutchinson is in the same boat, though. You know, when she was chair of the GOP of the state, she very much made it about Trump. I mean, the homepage of the Washington GOP was Trump. And I think that compared to what Tina Podlodowski's been doing, which like I will give her a lot of credit for, instead of seeing areas like Spokane and being like, we'll never get those, at least like making them put in the work and showing up. And so I think all it does is it sort of reinvokes that big baby balloon, I think, which is, you know, and again, in areas where we have more people of color voting, we have more Latinx voters, families who have grown up in agriculture, migrant workers, like those are people who are showing up at the polls more and more, and they are not to be ignored.
So the Nunes tape probably won't really impact the 5th congressional district race. And the reason is simply that I don't think a lot of people will know about it unless Lisa Brown makes a big deal out of it or something like that.
The argument is that the Congress is there to be part of checks and balances, not just to protect a partisan.
I think the bigger issue is also it's just going to lead the National Party to cut funding. Like that they're going to look at that race and be like, ooh, that one might be a stinker.
But you were saying, Joni?
Well, simply,
I don't think that the National Party is going to cut the 4th ranking member of the House.
I mean, not cut it, but I think they definitely might look at other parties around the country and be like, this could be tough.
You know
I just
what?
I think it makes her look like she, Kathy McMorris Rogers, like she's part of the swamp.
Right.
She had this sort of doe-eyed look. I mean, she doesn't really ever, she didn't say much. She's not like really implicated on that tape as much as Devin Nunes is. But so I think she probably gets a pass on that.
Let's talk in the remaining time, state legislature. Again, we're talking, is there going to be a blue wave? If so, the legislature and the primary, the Democrats did relatively well in state legislative primaries. If both houses, in addition to the governor, were to become not just razor-thin majorities, but solidly Democratic, what would they do with that power? with that majority, strong majority?
Well, I can see sort of a much stronger environmental agenda, you know, much more like salmon restoration because of the high profile of the orcas, folks wanting to work on that. Solar panels, I can see that. I could see them taking up gun legislation themselves instead of making everything have to happen by citizen initiative.
I think a lot of the things that you've been seeing going through initiative are going to end up just happening in the legislature. I think.
But nobody said state income tax.
I don't think
well,
state
I haven't
income
had a
tax,
chance but... to talk yet.
I think they'll start with capital
I think
gains.
You will have a capital gains capital tax, gains. Which is an income tax yep. on capital gains. There's yep. no way you can distinguish a capital gains tax from an income tax. It's an income tax.
But that's where they'll start the
and,
fight.
Well, fine, they can start there. But I would love it, Joni, if they would focus attention on salmon restoration. But no, they've had them. But I don't think they will. You've got
they have
attorney.
To have a big enough majority.
Oh, they've got the majorities now to do it if they wanted to. The governor doesn't really care, and it's not a priority for the Speaker of the House. If they had the votes, I mean, they have the votes if they wanted to push it. It's just not a priority for them.
The governor doesn't care. Maybe this is a good segue into to Orca update because the governor has this task force. He certainly
which demonstrates he doesn't care.
Well, tell me about that. So, first of all, for those who are interested in our local orcas, you know, we've got this population down to 75 animals. Two of them in immediate danger. A mother's been carrying her dead calf for more than 2 weeks. A 4-year-old, 3.5-year-old whale looks emaciated, maybe sick. And we didn't know where they were this week for a while, but yesterday fisheries officials found the pod off San Juan Island. They injected the little one with antibiotics. They might try to feed both of them some live salmon off the back of a boat. The governor has a task force aimed at what to do about there's so many other issues, right? There's orcas and there's salmon and there's dams. And Bill Bryant, you just said the governor doesn't actually care.
No, the governor doesn't care.
Why would you say that?
Well, first of all,
I think that's a little unfair.
I don't think it's unfair at all. He's had, 6 years now? And actually, we've gone backwards on salmon recovery. And he's actually cut funding to programs. We have an attorney general who's taking on the tribes and trying to resist moving forward on preserving habitat. We have gone backwards in the last 6 years.
What are you advocating?
I was on the Puget Sound Partnership Executive Board or Executive Environmental Board, whatever you call it, Ecosystems Board, under Governor
Gregoire.
You're
going to get a phone call.
I know. Mm-hmm. We know what needs to be done.
What's that? What do you want done?
We need to be, if we're serious about saving Puget Sound, which is then restoring salmon runs, protecting the orca.
Yeah.
Let's pick a date that's aggressive but realistic, 2030, 2035, and say beyond that point, there will be no disposal of treated water or storm water into Puget Sound. Quit treating Puget Sound like our toilet.
Dam removal. What do you say?
We need to see the data on that. I think that there's a lot of other issues in Puget Sound and things going on in the ocean, and I don't think that there's a direct correlation to the dam removal.
Oh, I talked to several scientists last year when I was reporting on orca miscarriages that talked a lot about dam removal, mostly because...
But it's all related to the actual return of salmon and the populations of feeding salmon coming
back.
It
also has to do with the temperature of the water.
Exactly. Right.
So
I was
this
just
is the other
say.
Thing. It has to, and so it also is things like reforestation. It's things like restoring culverts, obviously, which is something that's been coming up a lot, not dumping treated water into streams too, construction waste and runoff. But then the damming, the other thing with the damming is, you know, initially the dams were part of the energy production and it was to create a shipping sort of thoroughfare from, you know, the inland to the outer coast. The electricity that's created is like really minor compared to what you could
the
be creating.
River dams are more for navigation.
Some
than
of this is fixable and some of it isn't. When you have the blob,
when you are dumping raw sewage into Puget
not
Sound,
for dumping
King
raw sewage
County
into Puget
was
Puget
doing
Sound.
That last year.
Whoa,
we have stormwater runoff.
You can
that
still
high
dump
water,
off your boat. You can still just like
dumping off
your
the boat is nothing compared to what municipalities are putting into the water 24/7. And if we're serious. And I don't think we are, and I don't think the governor is, or he would not have appointed a 42 or 47 member panel. That's the last thing we need right now. If you're governor and you really care, you don't have a big press conference and appoint 40 some people to a special committee. What you do is you call in three people who know what in the hell they're talking about, and you say, I need options in 30 days.
So I've watched politicians create task forces till I'm blue in the face, and they're and they're blue in the face, I guess, as well. And sometimes task forces are sort of ways to put a problem to the side, which is what you're suggesting. And sometimes they come up with things that then lead to solutions. And so I don't think you can just, you speaking can say, Jay Inslee doesn't care. He put some pretty good people on there.
But the Puget Sound Partnership has an action plan. We don't need another task force to come up with another action plan.
This one is specifically aimed at the orcas, and
to save the salmon. You have to protect habitat.
All of that, you realize the salmon runs have much to do with the water temperature, as Hannah said, and some things that we can't fix. What about ship traffic? The orcas don't like noisy ships.
Right.
There's all kinds of things. We better get on it.
Well, and there's a lot of things that are going to run in with industry too. This is the other thing: is you're going to run into people in construction. You're going to run into people in shipping who are going to say like, "Well, we can't make these changes because it'll ruin our business." And so I think that's the other thing they're trying to head off a lot.
I would argue that the private sector actually has borne a lot of the brunt because they will have third party lawsuits brought against them if they don't.
Correct.
It's municipalities and local governments that continue to dump crap into Puget Sound.
I would love to see the Port of Seattle taking a stronger.
What would be the hardest part? 8 years ago to make sure the Port of Seattle became a leader in Puget Sound recovery, and it is.
It really is.
I'll give you that one.
It was not a priority when I left 8 years later. Yeah. It was a priority.
Yep.
And we have restored habitat along the Duwamish.
Yep.
We
and
have
I think
programs
that,
to treat stormwater.
I have
storm
a question. Yep. What would be the hardest part about not dumping treated water into Puget Sound?
Where do you put it?
Where it goes.
You have to actually...
So who
You would shut down West... Was it West
Point?
West Point. And you would then have to truck it or pipe it upland and dispose it into the watershed.
And who suffers? I want to know who's paying that cost.
The taxpayers would have to pay that cost.
Well, it also depends on how you move it. You know, it's building a pipeline, and now you have that whole environmental debacle. And then, I mean, the other thing, it's really similar to what's happening with plastics right now, where we can't keep just shipping our plastic to China anymore, so it's just piling up, and we're like, oh, God, we're going to really have to invest in a way to actually recycle it here at home.
Also, the culvert ruling could be helpful that recently came out, two, 3 weeks ago, something like that.
That's the ruling that the state is on the hook for improving, widening all these culverts that run underneath the roads, and it's hard for salmon to get through them.
All of this is in the Puget Sound Partnership Action Plan. We don't need another task force.
You're calling for tax increases, Bill Bryant, to pay.
That was what I was going to ask.
That's where I'm going.
I was going to ask about that.
Republican Bill Bryant.
I don't think you need tax increases. I think you need to be. I think you need to spend the money we've got in a way that reflects our priorities. Unfortunately, I think for the most people, saving Puget Sound is not a priority.
You can't tell what a Republican's going to say today. You know that?
It's a wild time. It's a wild time.
wild time. Wild orcas. We'll talk probably next week about what they do about these orcas because it's decision point regarding. They're not saying they want to trap the orcas because these families, these pods are so close.
You can't do that.
You can't do it. They're saying we're not going to pull the dead calf away from this mother. What are they able to do?
Well, they're doing some of what you said at the top. They're doing that antibiotic for the one.
Yeah.
Right.
They may do the feeding thing if they can figure it out.
We'll see.
And, maybe they're keeping boats away.
I'm not against spending funds to save these two, but let's take this moment and realize that this is not sustainable and that we can't sustain or save every orca that is damaged. We have to begin a 20-year plan to restore the integrity of Puget Sound. And if we don't, we're going to continue to play whack-a-mole trying to save this one or that one. And we're going to, when we die, leave an ecosystem which is much worse than we found it, and that's totally antithetical to the ethic of Washington State, where we leave our campground better than we found it.
I agree completely with what you just said. It has to be, and I'm not against the task force. I think if they come up with 5-10 things to do, I'm good with that. I'm good with the long-term plan to improve Puget Sound.
Okay. Former Port of Seattle Peace Commissioner Bill Bryant there, the Republican. Hannah Brooks Olson, writer, political strategist, now editing Real Change. Joni Balter, and we'll talk about Real Change and homelessness in a moment. Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail, Seattle Channel, and let's talk Pearl Jam when we come back as we're covering the news of the week on The Week in Review. We are live tweeting this show. The show is Week in Review. The live tweeting is happening at KUOW, so come join us. I'm Bill Radke. Tonight, Pearl Jam plays their second of two shows at Safeco Field. The band is donating more than $1 million from the show to fight homelessness. Add that to local businesses and fans they got involved. Total donations expected to be about $12 million. The question is, how do you spend $12 million to help people with no place to live? Our local governments can't even agree on that answer. Hannah, you are involved in this issue. You're you're editing Real Change, the newspaper right now, which a lot of our locals will know, Real Change. I buy it from people on the streets selling it. What do you know about what Pearl Jam ought to know when it comes to combating homelessness?
Well, one of the things I actually am very so when I first heard about the home shows, I did what I think a lot of people did, which is I was a little skeptical and a little cynical because I was like, oh, they're just having a concert for rich people to bring awareness. Yuck.
Right. Then, tickets cost how much?
Yeah, exactly. But then so they did a few things. They made a bunch of tickets available to people. I mean, for like our vendors, like a bunch of Real Change vendors went. A lot of people who volunteered through United Way got to go. And so like a really diverse range of people got to go have this experience. But the other thing is the way that they have brought together a bunch of different community members and like community stakeholders. So, you know, Glassy Baby and Easy Street Records and Georgetown Brewing. Like Georgetown Brewing made a special beer and $2 from every six pack goes to the cause, like to homelessness. So basically what they're doing is they're doing this cool thing where they're siphoning off little bits of money from what people do otherwise and then putting it towards homelessness, which is functionally what taxes do. But that aside, mm-hmm. it has brought together a lot of people who wouldn't otherwise be necessarily making donations. And then they did this thing on the 8th where they had the night of the first show, something like 80 restaurants donated, you know, 10% of their revenue each to the cause as well. And so, and they have, Pearl Jam has their foundation, and then they're also working with a bunch of nonprofits in town. Chief Seattle Club is sort of the one that sort of made me feel the most trusting of this whole endeavor. I got to talk to Stone Gossard with one of our vendors, Daryl. He conducted the interview, and I just kind of got to sit in and watch. It was a great interview. He totally killed it. But one of the things I learned during that process was that the guys from Pearl Jam had gone on about a year-long listening tour where they had just gone to service providers and sat in and asked, like, what do we need to do? What isn't happening? What can be done? How can we help? And so this entire process is very much guided by what they learned from people who have been in this world and doing this thing. And I just have an immense amount of respect for that.
So where's the money going?
That is a great question. It's going to go into a series of grants that are going to go to service providers locally and that are going to go into some other projects they're working on. They have not been super duper clear about it yet, but because they're working with existing, with Rakes Foundation, with they did a thing with Donors Choose to like help fund homeless student initiatives. And so there's like a variety of initiatives that are going to get this cash. But then the other thing that's also happening is a bunch of local businesses have sort of, you know, and people have sort of borne witness to what's going on in a way that's not as scary and awful and sad, which I think is really important. And it sounds sort of flip, but it's not. I think it feels very intractable to a lot of people. And then they see like, oh, we can do something.
Here's what I like about it. So you have your sort of local, can we call them the philosophers of a certain generation? They're giving voice to there's a Seattle group giving voice to a Seattle problem. And, you know, I didn't find it at all, like, worrisome. I thought it was a great idea because some people, their eyes glaze over when they read homelessness stories, but they'll read about Pearl Jam, mm-hmm. and they'll identify with it. Yep. They'll connect to it, and they'll even be, oh, yeah, where is that money going? Mayor's office, from what I understand, about $8 million of the $12 million is going to local nonprofits like Mary's Place, mm-hmm. United Way, that kind of thing. There is an advisory board. Cover your ears, Bill.
task force.
Sorry. Okay.
Hey, an advisory board is different than a task force.
Okay. Very,
I know,
very different.
I know, but you didn't know the name of your task force, so whatever. But
the ecosystems board. It came to me afterwards.
Happy to hear that. Happy to facilitate
just
that.
Delete all those emails you got.
And then about another $4 million of this maybe goes to like this joint effort between the city and the county trying to figure out you know, how it would get more to youth and families. So this is really good stuff.
Yeah.
Hats off to Pearl Jam for doing this, for making it highly visible and getting real money to a problem.
Yeah. Are they making any decisions? Are they disagreeing with anyone? Because I'm used to talking about how should we spend money on homelessness, and is it short term? Is it long term? Is it permanent housing? Is it shelter?
It's all that, because it depends on which population you're talking about. If we're talking about homeless teens in the University District, their needs are going to be very different than the needs of retirees. And Hannah has a great piece in this week's
Real Change.
Real Change, yeah. Ashley Archibald wrote it. It's really good.
Yeah, it's really very good about the needs of retirees who are finding themselves homeless. Those are very different populations. Mm-hmm. I volunteer at a shelter that for men over 55. The needs of those men, many of whom are chronically homeless, are very different.
Is that St. Martin de Porres?
It's related to St. Martin de Porres, yeah.
About that.
Their needs are very different. And even within that group of men over 55, the reasons they're homeless and what they need in order to lift themselves off the streets are very different. So whenever you can bring people together and have them focus on the issue and have them begin to understand that there is not a single solution. It's not just rapid rehousing, or it's not just tiny villages, or it's not just more drug therapy. It's all of that. Mm-hmm. And that we need to have different solutions for different populations. That's a good thing. And if this concert helps bring attention to how complicated and diverse the problem is, and how diverse and complex the solutions are going to have to be, that will be a good thing, too.
Low-key, are you sure you're still a Republican? Like, are you paused? Because I'm just what I'm hearing from you is exactly...
I am a Washington State Republican. I'm proud of the tradition of Dan Evans and others, and I will carry it on.
And I think you're exactly right. The thing I always quote my friend Alex Hudson always says, you know, it's not a silver bullet, it's silver buckshot. And this idea, you know, I talked to also Rex Holbein, who started Facing Homelessness, and I sort of was asking him about this. And he was like, yeah, you know, what I like about it is that everyone can bring their layer. And he said, you know, if you think about how many people live in King County and how many people live outside in King County, we have them beat. There's more people inside than outside. So we have the numbers. If everybody does whatever little thing they are. And the thing he said, he always asks the volunteers, and I am obsessed with this, and I'm going to tell it to everyone I talk to over the weekend. He always asks them two questions. What are you good at and what are you passionate about? And then that's how he decides how someone volunteers. Because, like, for something like, you know, like a concert, and yeah, the tickets or whatever, some amount of money I can't afford, a lot of the people who went would never have cut a check for that much money and then, like, given it to Real Change or an organization, but they'll cut that check to go to a concert because that's what they're passionate about. And so how do you route people's interests and passion into something that can be helpful? Because it's not all, like, a soup kitchen with a hairnet on. Like, you can do other things.
Speaking of the emergency shelter versus long-term solution, what do you think of the King County Board of Health considering setting up FEMA-style tents as emergency shelters before winter comes? I know it's hard to imagine when it's going to be, you know, 90 here. And
wait, does it rain here anymore?
Well, that's actually...
is there a climate change task force we can ask?
Yeah, let's ask.
or advisory board.
No, actually, we should create another one.
Ooh, there's not enough homelessness task force. You're right, Bill.
FEMA tents... Short term, it's going to get cold and wet. I mean, okay, or is that taking the eye off the ball of long term solutions?
Listen,
population are you trying to serve?
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. And the thing is, people die outside. More homeless people die every year than people are murdered in King County. That's just a fact. People die because it's cold and they're wet and they get skin diseases. Their lifespan is literally half that of housed people, like on average. So a tent, if it saves someone's life one night, great. It's extremely low cost. We know Assessor John Wilson has already identified like 30 parcels of land around that we just own, that the city owns, that they could put it on. Like, fine, put up a porta potty, let them sleep in the night. Have social workers there on site to then
there.
Help.
That's the
thing.
See, I don't...
But, you know, we need, if you're going to do this, then have some assistance on site for people who want help.
Yep.
Part
have
of the problem. Have you been up to Licton Springs?
Yeah, okay. I did a story there.
Oh, did you? Okay. My wife and I did a little tour of it.
This is the tiny house village?
Yeah. I think it's actually the model of what you do not want to build.
Really?
Yeah. I do not call them, it's not a village.
This is one of the low barrier.
Yes.
They have problems with.
It's shacks. There's no running water. A village, a tiny house village, which works, is Cahuti Village in Olympia, where they have a toilet. They actually have their own little area. They have common showering and kitchen facilities. They have to monitor in terms of guests coming in. Mm-hmm. There are no drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. They have to work, and they will help them find a job. One third of whatever they earn goes towards their rent. Mm-hmm. There's counseling to help them work on their resume and do interview skills and keep the job once they got it. You go up to the Shack Village on Aurora, there's drugs, there's alcohol. If you want services, there's no clear pathway to even getting them.
Oh, there's a social worker? No, I was there. I interviewed a guy there, and I was talking to him.
I was asking, so if somebody says, okay, I want some alcohol therapy, what would you do? Or I need some
alcohol therapy?
Alcohol therapy. That sounds like Friday night.
I was going to say, that's Friday night. That's right around 3:30 today.
Alcohol counseling. It's Friday afternoon. I'm thinking about alcohol therapy. No, if you need alcohol, if you need counseling, I said, how would you get it? And they were like, well, we'd try and put them in touch with somebody, but there was no clear pathway. If we're going to set up these villages, we need to have clear pathways.
But that's a money issue.
It is a money issue. But we have a lot of money. Yep. It's how we're
spending it. We have a lot of money. I don't think it's an either or here. I think if you can do tents for one population, yes. I like the idea, Bill, of having services there. So maybe it leads to a long-term kind of solution. But then, of course, you don't just do that. You do all the other things. This is a complicated problem, requires complicated answers.
Okay, so moving on. Now, yeah, it's a good point. If you there's something about even flow 25 years ago or whatever that got you to buy the record 10, you maybe got a chance to get back in touch with, oh, I guess that made me feel kind of good about having some compassion for somebody who's on a pillow made of concrete, and that Pearl Jam was bringing that all together in their show Wednesday, and as they will again tonight. Let's talk about some more of the news of the week, the show box, the Mariners, and more when we come back in the Week in Review. There's Even Flow. Nice touch. Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke here with Hannah Brooks Olson and Bill Bryant and Joni Balter. The Showbox Theater has been nominated for landmark status. Local Historic Preservation Group submitted the landmark nomination this week after a BC-based developer filed plans to build an apartment tower on the Showbox site on First Avenue downtown. The groups have names like Historic Seattle and Vanishing Seattle. Is Seattle vanishing if the Showbox goes, or just moving on?
Well, I would say too much of Seattle is in fact vanishing, and so I'm all for ways to save this venue, and I don't think that's that debated. I think the whole city council's for this. The question now is, what is the timing, and how are you going to do it? What will be the result? I think there was some misunderstanding, at least on my part, as to what the timing was. Council member Shauna Sawant made it seem like, oh my God, if we don't do this now, it'll be gone forever.
She wants to expand the Pike Place Market Historic District to include where the Showbox is.
Half block, I think it's south and east, something like that.
Temporarily, anyway.
Temporarily. But I'm hearing that the deadline is not what was first thought, the deadline to figure out when this project, as they say, vests. It is now, I'm told, middle of October. So there's some time to come up with a solution. For Shauna Sawant politically, I get why she wanted to jump in here and do this. You know, this is her doing something for her actual district. There's a lot of folks who would really like to see this Showbox saved throughout the city, but especially where Shauna is.
Is that her district?
No, it's not her district.
It's not.
No, I'm talking about Capitol Hill.
Oh, yeah.
Excuse me, I am talking about Capitol Hill, but those people do like the Showbox.
Yes.
They
yes.
don't have happen
yes.
to have it in her.
It's her
district.
Constituency.
It's her constituency. Yes. Thank you for making that sound better than it actually
That's right.
Did.
I couldn't remember Ecosystems Board. So.
fair enough. I talked about it this week to the founder of the band Death Cab for Cutie. Ben Gibbard sat down here right where you're sitting, Hannah Brooks Olson. Ben Gibbard was there. You don't seem to care.
I can't say that I do.
Fair enough. Ben Gibbard told me that Seattle is such a new place that it's hard for us to decide what's worth saving.
And that's it's the easy key. When it's, oh, this is Pioneer Square. This is the historic area of town. The buildings are all brick. You know, let's draw a line around that, save that. But, well, this building was built in the 50s. I don't know. You know, we could knock that down and put four townhouses there. I don't know if that really kind of, I don't know if that really kind of qualifies. And, you know, I think that that is one of the curses of living in such a young city, is that we don't, you know, our history is so shallow in a lot of these, in a lot of our neighborhoods, that we don't really have a sense of what's worth saving and what isn't worth saving. But I do think that when almost 100,000 Seattleites sign a petition, you know, they show up at city council meetings, they call their representatives, and they share their stories about how important this place is to them.
Bill, you wanted to talk about how we decide what's worth saving.
I think that's exactly the right question to ask. This is bigger than the showbox, and if we don't address it, we're going to keep having the same conversation over and over again.
How would we address it in a big way?
So what we need to, I do think we're losing part of our soul. I do think that there are businesses and buildings that are integral to who we are as a city and a people. Let's identify them.
Right.
Let's build the list. It's also not fair to developers to have them go buy one of these, and then after they've bought it, for us, say, oh, no, that's one of our favorites. You can't do anything.
And people never outline them until after they get bought. This is what kills me, and this is what I think about the showbox. I think the showbox itself as a building is, like, less important than the fact that it's a venue and that it is an art space. And what we feel like we're losing a lot of times in Seattle is that ability to, like, be, like, a grungy music arts town, right? That's what we feel like we're losing. And I think that we don't ever pay attention to that until something's, like, on its way out or going. I think the other thing that's happening is a lot of the things that are going away and being replaced by something new feel like they're not something for a lot of us who really chose to move here. I moved to Seattle 9 years ago to work at KUOW. No big deal.
that is a big deal.
Yeah, I did. I lived in a brownstone in Belltown. I was very poor. And I moved here because this was a place that I thought was at a change point. It was 2009, right? Or 2008, 2009. And it was like, things were going to happen. A bunch of the construction was stalled. There was, like, no cranes at that point because everything had busted. And I was like, I wonder what's going to happen here. It felt like there was a lot of potential. And then I feel like the way it's changed, and I think a lot of people feel this way, is it has changed in the complete opposite way from what I was after.
So that's where you have to give Seattleites over time some credit.
Yeah.
For knowing when it's, you act like there's this just list of rules that would really work. I don't think it
right.
is like that. It's, you know it when you see it. Saving the Pike Place Market, not letting, and this goes way back, Walt Disney take over Seattle Center. You know it when you see
it. So what's on our list right now?
Or saving Gasworks Park, building Gasworks mm-hmm. Park.
Okay, so what's on the list?
So we need to build that list now.
Yeah.
And so that we're not playing, again, whack-a-mole, that every time something comes up, oh, no, we like that one, when really we don't even have criteria, and I think that's what
I know what I'm getting you for Christmas. Whack-a-mole.
Whack-a-mole.
Oh, see, I'm going to get him a hat that says I used to be a Republican. Because here's the thing. When you make that list, what you have to also do is probably make some investments with taxpayer dollars.
Well, yeah, then the people have to be prepared to stand up and say, okay, we're going to buy the development rights.
That's exactly what I mean.
And then the other problem we have when we're trying to protect these is you can protect a building, but you can't protect its use.
Right. This is the other thing, right? Because if you say you were to knock down the showbox and you put up a tall building, but you stipulate that it has to have a music venue underneath and then it has to have artist spaces that are owned and operated by the city or whatever, right? Like, there are ways to protect the use of things or to think about the use of things, which we can't do because when you landmark something, all you're doing is saying this building now cannot get new HVAC installed without permission.
Well, if you're going to change the venue, wouldn't that involve that would be a new building, a new space.
Right.
So in that case, why not have there's art spaces popping up in different places where they don't want to put a 44
right.
tower.
And I was actually arguing the opposite.
44-story
building. You can protect the building, but you can't protect it. It's going to be a music venue.
Right.
You can't force them to have concerts.
Right. They can landmark it, and then someone else can just buy it and put something else in.
Make it a restaurant.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is why you have a city council, and this is why you have the initiative process, because if folks don't get it, then those are mechanisms, those are ways that we come around and say, oops, we didn't mean to let this go. We want to preserve this. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think this idea, specifically the idea of Save the Showbox, is even controversial on the city council. There's plenty of votes for doing something. The question will come down to the details.
Right.
So the system will work. That's what I think.
Speaking of altering Seattle icons, the renovated Space Needle is open and waiting for you to look downward through its rotating glass floor.
I can't
cool?
wait to do it.
You're
it's
in?
It's really cool. It looks like a ride.
I
looks
can't
more
wait to
like
be able to
ride.
Afford it.
Yeah, Space Needle's
are they charging?
Space Needle's pricey. It's not a Pearl Jam concert ticket,
it's
but
not that much. But I can tell you, when I moved to the city, I didn't ever go to the Space Needle until I got to go for work. Like, I went as a reporter, and then I finally got to go because I was like, I can't.
You go up to the assignment desk and you say, you know, what are they doing at the Space Needle? They haven't done X, Y, or Z.
That's exactly what I did.
It works.
That's exactly how I got there. I recommend it for everyone.
All right.
I mean, I'm glad that the construction is over because also just from afar
It looked weird.
It looked weird.
Yeah. Looked like it was wrapped in some kind of weird packaging.
Like, I hated it. Like, I didn't expect to feel those feelings, and I saw it all wrapped up and under construction. I was like, oh, no.
Bill, you look like you want to say something about the Space Needle before we go.
Yeah, I just had coffee with Knut yesterday, who's our local expert on all things Space Needle. Yeah, and he
Knut Berger.
And we were talking about Showbox as well, and he made a very interesting comment that the renovation of the Space Needle is a demonstration of how we can modernize a historically important building for the 21st century, update it, modernize it, but preserve it at the same time.
Put a rotating glass floor above the bands that are playing.
Well,
and
you know what the Showbox and the Space Needle have in common? Well, you know, one time Mudhoney played on the roof of the Space Needle.
I didn't know.
That's the other time I got to be there.
See, you're using that angle for how to get
I try.
There.
I'm actually just a scammer. That's what I do. But the thing that the Space Needle and the Showbox have in common is they are both owned by extremely wealthy organizations/individuals. So there is also that element.
I was going to say, there's a ton of private money in the
both of those spaces.
Upgraded Space Needle. My.
Quick break, and then we drive toward the end of another Week in Review. Coming right back. Stay tuned. On the Week in Review, I'm Bill Radke. We're just about at the end of wrapping up another week. Let's see, the Seahawks preseason started last night in Soto. They lost to the Colts, but that doesn't really matter. Russell Wilson didn't get hurt in the preseason. Three Seahawks players left the field before the start of the national anthem, came back after it ended. You got a problem with that, Bill? Do you want Seahawks? There's a local institution being political. Do you want national anthem discussion for another season, or are you one of those fans who say, I just want to watch football and not think about
it? I want to watch football. I don't necessarily agree with what they're doing, but people have died for their right to do it.
It seems like every time our president doesn't like the running narrative, he just starts wailing on this issue. And it seems, I think this issue is so overblown. And just folks should do what they're going to do. And we won't be talking about this if we just kind of just mellow out about it. It's not the biggest deal in the world.
I'm not watching the NFL this year, and it's really difficult for me, but I am a lifelong football fan. I played football. I was the only girl on my flag football team in the fourth and fifth grade.
Uh-huh.
And my issue is not with anthem protests or anything like that. It's with TBI and the league's handling of domestic violence, and I can't, and it's really hard. It's harder than I thought. Even just last night with preseason, it was harder than I thought it would be.
The Seahawks are making it easier and easier for you every season.
Well, and I mean, most of my favorite players are not on the team. Like, I'm going to be watching all my favorite players elsewhere. I'm going to be, watching my beloved Richard Sherman.
Michael Bennett off in Philadelphia, et cetera.
Bless.
Speaking of which, about a month ago, sports teams changing, sports stars changing. About a month ago, I told my 8-year-old son that the Mariners had a good chance of making the playoffs for the first time since way before he was born. And we don't even really go to Mariner games. He's maybe seen two, but he got super interested. So every 10 minutes for the last month, he wants to know the Mariners score, which for the last month has meant telling him every 10 minutes that the Mariners are losing again.
Hey, not last night.
They are no longer likely to make the playoffs.
Did they win last night?
They sure did win last night against Justin Verlander was pitching, and it was because they reorganized. Oh, so good.
Oakland won, too, and there's still two and a half games.
However, this is a giant swoon, and they peaked at the wrong time, and you don't try to do your best win all those one-run ball games in June and July. You do that in August and September if you want to go anywhere and end the off.
I think the games all count the same amount, don't they?
Yeah.
And a win's a win. Here's the thing. A win is a win.
A win is a win, but you're talking about trending, and so, they just – and it happens every time. Every time there's an all-star game, you have some team that just refuses to lose. That's the Mariners saying, and they were refusing to lose, and they are now – much more willing, and that every 10-minute update sounds like my husband.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely have the AL West standings just, bookmarked on my phone. And I pull them up, and I'm like, how are we? And we are coming up. We're playing Houston Astros, and then we're going to play the Oakland Athletics, which is the other team I grew up rooting for.
That'll fix somebody.
No big deal. And that'll sort out the AL West.
Yeah, if Seattle can make ground against the Oakland, that's a different deal.
Here's the thing. You know what? Oakland, my family's from Oakland, and they are long-suffering A's fans. There's a little part of me where I'm like, you guys deserve it.
I appreciate that. I do try to remember that sad people in one city means happy people in another city. So
thank you.
Well,
in a city that has had some real, they're having this whole thing with the Raiders. Poor Oakland. Seriously.
That's what we should think about.
That's
poor
right.
Oakland.
Thank you.
What about poor Felix? Yesterday, the Mariners announced that their biggest star, Felix Hernandez, is now too bad to even be a starting
pitcher.
Literally
a national tragedy.
Literally a national tragedy.
I mean, just he we all know this. He gave his best years to the worst Mariner team.
Right.
And that's the Shakespearean
yes.
tragedy.
He
of it.
Played, Fort Willa played 14 seasons right in that trough of when the Mariners were the longest suffering team in the whole league.
The reason you have a drought is you can't line these things up. You have to line up the hitting and the pitching at the same time. Those are the teams that advance.
I hereby nominate the Mariners' losing record for historic landmark status, that we just reserve it in perpetuity. This is what distinguishes us from New York.
I think management needs
Boston.
A task force.
We need
we need an advisory board.
Well, isn't that partially what Ichiro's doing, board. Right? That's Ichiro's job.
The Mariners are kind of a losing record task force.
Right. And they
convene
information about what
year.
To do next. They yeah. don't know.
All right. It's about time to get out of here. The Seattle soda tax was either going to drive us toward healthier drinking or raise a lot of money. Answer, it raised a lot of money, more than $10 million in the first 6 months. We don't really know about the health habits yet.
I think we'll find that out. Take a look at Philadelphia. The use of sugary drinks is down 40%. So we don't know our numbers yet, but this is an important thing to take a look at what's happening with all ages, but I was going to say childhood obesity and diabetes. It's really a national health concern, and we should be glad that the city, you know, did this. Now, of course, you have that initiative coming with all kinds of crazy talk about how they're going to tax your groceries, which, of course, they are not allowed to do by yeah. initiative 345.
Bill Bryan's giving you side eye about the soda tax.
That's cool.
I'm not giving you side eye. I'm just kind of confused because if you really think it's working, then how is revenue increasing beyond projections? And so the question is we don't know.
That's the catch-22 about it.
But you know, if it really were reducing it the way you were suggesting, I'm not sure that revenue would be as high as it is.
I mean, I also have concerns about the implementation of it, but I think the city completely bungled it on the rollout with the implementation because most people think it's a sales tax that's on the consumer side, which it of course is not.
Well, but it is a sales tax.
But it is, but it also isn't.
It's a sales tax on the consumer side.
My answer to your point is
if you're buying your soda at the checkout,
distributors,
cash register, whether it's an excise tax or a sales tax, you're paying.
But so here's the question, how much did like stores and grocery stores like how much did they increase prices
because
they did right more than the cost of the excise tax. So I'm curious about
estimates, and I don't think they can count that well at the city.
We're gonna have to get out of here and go get.
I agree with Joni.
Dang, Joni's done.
These are City of Seattle projections. I don't know what they're worth.
Let's go have a milk-based drink that's not subject to the tax together. We have to get on out of here.
Or alcohol therapy.
I was already paying taxes on that, and gladly so.
It's the Week in Review on KUOW with Hannah Brooks Olson, editing Real Change Now, writer, political strategist. Joni Balter with Seattle Channel. She hosts Civic Cocktail. Former Port of Seattle Commissioner Bill Bryant, former Republican candidate for governor. Hannah questioning his Republicanness, but you're still an R, right?
I'm still an R.
You're not Chris Vance yet.
I am so
far from that, man. That's just sad.
Wow.
Speaking of sad,
ouch. Bill, we're friends, right?
Shady in here.
We're friends, right?
At least it's shady somewhere. We're gonna be back with you on Monday for the records. See you then. Bye, everybody.